Today, the major topic is going to be, we're going to talk about Poland. Poland, no Polish jokes. Poland, P-O-L-A-N-D. You know, where most of us are probably from, Eastern Europe. We're going to talk about a lot of centuries, but medieval to Renaissance. Before I do that, I want to just mention a couple of things regarding Spain and the period of time we're in, which I didn't get to mention yesterday. First of all, a little bit of trivia about, I mentioned Don Yitzhak Abarbanel, who is the treasurer for the, Ferdinand and Isabella, who is the one who tried to get the expulsion order rescinded. By the way, the expulsion order was not officially rescinded until a few years ago. Okay, King Juan Carlos. Spain, by the way, also is the last country in Europe, in Western Europe, to give Jews citizenship. In 1918 is when Jews got citizenship in Spain, finally. So the expulsion was officially in effect. This was the last 10 years. They got rid of it. But anyway, by the way, I think once we get finished getting the money out of the Germans and the Austrians and the Swiss, I think that the World Jewish Committee should go over the Spanish. For probably we're talking about the real value of property and money lost during the expulsion probably exceeds that of which was lost in Europe during the Holocaust. We're talking about a huge, very very large wealthy Jewish community. Just to mention, Abarbanel was so important, to the Spanish who wanted to get rid of the rest of the Jews that they offered him to stay, and he could keep 9 other Jews with him to make a minyan to pray. He turned it down. Okay, he left with the 150 or so thousand Jews. They don't all leave together and go to the same place as I mentioned, but he left with them. I today know several people who are direct descendants of him, and he of course has a very famous commentary on the Bible, the Abarbanel. So if you hear that name, you appreciate it. He's a very significant person in Spanish Jewish history. The other thing that I wanted to mention was we talked about Christopher Columbus yesterday and the really cool stories of his Jewish connections. I wanted to just talk about one other very important Jewish impact on this period of time. The late 15th, 16th centuries fall in a period of European history called the Renaissance, but they have a specific title given to them, the Age of Exploration. You guys remember, in 7th grade or 10th grade, he talked about Columbus and Magellan and Vasco da Gama and Amerigo Vespucci. I hope you still do that stuff, right? This is the period of time when a lot of great feats of exploration via ship are accomplished. Magellan going around the world, the Christopher Columbus discovery of America. He doesn't even get the name. Amerigo Vespucci gets the country named after him, right? I mentioned yesterday that, in the grand sweep of the Jewish view of history, everything that's happening is happening for a deeper reason. The discovery of the New World has a tremendous impact on Europe, right? In terms of Spain and England and making colonies and creating a whole part of the world. Not that there weren't people there already, but really, those of us from America or anywhere else like that, Canada, the 51st state, as they say. No offense, Jeff. It's all part. It's a very relatively new development in history. And as we all know, America is going to go from being, a place inhabited by a bunch of Stone Age Native Americans to this huge superpower a few hundred years later. But in the grand sweep of things, we say, as I mentioned yesterday, this is huge impact on Jewish history. That the vast majority of the Jews of the world are going to end up eventually in North America. Very, very interesting. So we have to look at it as part of this master plan of God's, creating the cure before the disease, making an outlet for the Jewish people when all other doors are going to be shut. But as such, Jews play a very, very important role in the whole age of exploration. Not that there are great Jewish discoverers, with the exception of Christopher Columbus, who may have been Jewish. We know of no other major Jewish explorers. But the technology behind the age of exploration is overwhelmingly Jewish. One of the great little unknown pieces of trivia. For a couple of examples. First of all, the major tools used by all navigators before they had, satellite positioning and everything we use in the world today was the quadrant. Okay? And the astrolabe, which are two pieces of equipment that allow you, when you're out at sea and don't have landmarks, to measure your position at sea by looking at the sun and the stars. The quadrant used by all explorers in the late 15th and 16th centuries was called Jacob's staff. And it was created by Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, the Gershonides. A rabbi created the tool. The astrolabe, the other major piece of navigational equipment, was created by two court physicians to the king of Portugal, Jewish court physicians. Okay, in their spare time they created navigational tools. So the two major pieces of technology used by all explorers. The other third piece that you need to find your way around is obviously a map. Okay, maps are incredibly important, and one of the great unknown stories of Jewish contributions to civilizations are Jews are the great cartographer map makers of human history. Anyone know the most famous atlas used by all explorers of this period of time? Columbus used it. the Catalan Atlas. Ever heard of the Catalan Atlas? There are copies still in existence. The Catalan Atlas is the creation of a Jewish family from Mallorca in Spain called the Crescas. Okay, it is hands down considered to be the greatest and most significant collection of maps used by everyone. Abraham Cresca, I think it's his grandson, will eventually become a Milano, will convert to Christianity. His name is Jaime Ribe. He will be invited by Prince Henry of Portugal, the navigator, the famous person who supported all the Portuguese exploration, to head the Nautical Observatory in Portugal. Like he's like the major guy in charge of all the scientific research behind exploration. What's interesting about the Ribe family and the Cresca family is as soon as within a generation of the family becoming Christians, they disappear and they stop making maps. Very interesting. Now, why were Jews so good at map making? It could be that Jews had connections everywhere. They could get information from fellow Jews. They were literate and whatever. It's just a topic I don't want to get into. But we have to appreciate that much of what's going on in the age of exploration is also made possible by Jewish technology. And it's not a class on Jewish pride and, you know, trivia. But next time you study the topic of the age of exploration, you can appreciate a little more Jewish impact on it. Okay, the last thing I want to mention before getting into Poland is that this period of time we're talking about, the end of the end of the 15th century, is a borderline that separates two periods of rabbis, so to speak. We've been talking about Tanaim, right, and Amorayim, and Sefarayim, and Gaonim, and Rishonim, who begin in the early 11th century, from the Gaonic period. The period of Rishonim is going to end in 1439. Okay, that's the date given for the end of the Rishonim, which is a few decades before the expulsion from Spain, but which corresponds to very significant changes that are going to go on in the Jewish world. Again, it's not like one day I woke up and said, we're not Rishonim anymore. Now we are Achronim. Achronim are the guys, we're post-Achronim now. Achronim are the guys who are the leaders of the Jewish community, people like the Chafetz Chaim, guys like that, Rav Chaim Moshe Grzinski, all these people are going to be the rabbis from the mid-15th century until the mid-20th century, to World War II. The Holocaust ends the period of the Achronim, and now we have post-Achronim, which is a really sad state. We don't have a title for us anymore. That's how bad off we are. But Rishon, as I mentioned, is extremely important when you guys, please God, all make it up to the rabbinic ordination. You learn, as I mentioned before, the laws of Hora'ah, how to learn out Jewish law. The way we learn out Jewish law today is to follow a Rishon's, Rashi, Rambam, Balei Tosfos, follow a Rishon's understanding of a piece of Gemara, of Talmud. Okay, why the Rishonim? Because the Rishonim are the last group of people that have a clear, unbroken transmission process going back to Moses. Okay, once that period of time stops, the train of transmission is going to get even worse now because it's corresponding to huge shifts in Jewish population. Also, the printing press is going to come into existence right at this period of time, 1453 in Gutenberg, Germany. The mass distribution of books is going to have a big impact on the Jewish world as it has on the Gentile world. You have much more access to information indirectly, albeit you don't need necessarily someone to teach you as much. You can get books you know what I mean? When you don't have books, or when your entire village has one copy of the Talmud, everyone's got to go and use the one copy and learn from one guy. And once we get to the printing press, you can own your own copy. Okay, so it's going to definitely change. It's going to have a much bigger impact, by the way, printing, on the Gentile world and the Jewish world. Matter of fact, we see, and we'll talk about printing in a few minutes, when I talk about the printing presses set up in Europe, but Jews are going to actually be less into printing books initially than Gentiles. Why? In a couple minutes I'll try and answer that. At least I have a theory on that, which I heard from Rav Yaakov Weinberg. But anyway, from that period of time onward, we enter the period of the Achronim. Okay, and again, practically speaking, when you guys, and this is how it works today, you want to learn out how to apply Jewish law, and again, there are different variations of a certain piece of halacha. You can pick any opinion of any Rishon and follow his understanding of how he understands the Gemara. And it's legitimate. So it's a very important concept to understand. Okay, let's now go into Poland. I know a place that most of us don't want to visit, but yeah.
Now, could we read different ones and pick one that seems like...
Absolutely. Provided you know what you're doing, yes. You as little pintle yid, as they call it, simple Jew who knows something, you can't be an Amorite, you can say, I'm holding by the Rambam here. That's what happens in the Jewish world today. That's how it works, exactly. Please God, you make it to Smicha. This is one of the best part of the Smicha program, is Klali Hora'ah. Okay, it's fascinating how it actually works today. Before we go into Jewish history, let's look what's going on in the world. Back up a little bit before 1500, before the expulsion. The whole period from mid-14th to mid-17th, let's say 1350 to 1650, is called the Renaissance. Renaissance, it means, what's the word? It means rebirth. Rebirth of what? Rebirth of classical knowledge. And again, it doesn't mean in the morning of the 1350 and January 1st, everyone woke up and said, the Middle Ages is over, we're now in the Renaissance. You know, we're now. These are all terms that were labeled, we're talking about, by historians in the last 100 years. And they try and pick dates that fit into certain major changes. Europe is going, when I talk about Renaissance, we're talking about Europe, primarily Western Europe. And again, this being the dominant culture in terms of Western Europe spreading out and influencing so many other parts of the world, what's happening in Western Europe has like a domino effect on what's going to happen in a lot of other places in the world. And it's certainly going to have a big impact on the Jewish people who are scattered throughout Western Europe. Renaissance, Europe goes from the Middle Ages, Dark Ages, so to speak, not so dark as I mentioned previously, but a period of time when you don't have strong central authority, the Catholic Church is the strongest body, we have a feudal economic system of which the Church plays a major part in, etc. What the process that's going on now is, in the Renaissance, is first of all the rise of strong central authority. You're going to have very powerful kings emerging in England and in France. The power of the Church is going to wane. Not only the political power because of the rise of strong temporal leaders in Europe, but also because religion in general is going to be on the way out. Because what the Renaissance is the rebirth of is of classical Greek and primarily Greek thought, which again was lost to Europe. And as I mentioned before, primarily due a lot to the Muslims, but also to Jews reintroducing it back into Europe, is going to enter the mind of Western Europeans. And humanism that we know today, the human being the center, focusing on me now here, the physical world, the human being, as opposed to the spiritual world and God and cathedrals and all that stuff, is largely a product of Greek culture and Greek thought. So it's the rediscovery, which is going to have a huge impact on the political realities, the religious realities, the economic realities. It's all going to be changing very much. You have the rise, again, age of exploration, strong central government, huge upshooting cultural creativity, and expansion of economies and trade, and you name it. It's a very significant change in the world. And again, it has very big impact on the Jews. The big personalities, by the way, this period of time, if you're just interested, talking about in terms of literature, you know, like Leonardo da Vinci, one of the great inventors, Boccaccio, Chaucer, Henry VIII, Ferdinand, you know, Elizabeth I, all these guys, these strong central monarchs. Okay, even people like, you know, all the kings of France, Louis XIV, he's a little towards the end of that period of time. But these are the great strong Renaissance personalities at this period of time. In terms of the Jewish world, the big switch is obviously where the major centers of Jewish population are going to be. Now, if you can imagine in your mind, you just close your eyes and you imagine Jews starting out in Israel and then moving during Byzantine period, early Islamic period in the Middle East and then spreading out into Turkey. And by the way, this period of time also corresponds to the fall of the Byzantine Empire, 1453, the same year as the printing press, the same year that Constantinople falls. The Eastern Christian Empire is gone. Okay, so Jewish populations moving throughout the Arab world, moving into Spain, and then, as we mentioned in previous classes, Jews being expelled, right, in the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries from Western Europe and from Spain, and also leaving to a large extent the Middle East. This is going to be the rise of Ashkenazic Jewry. Okay, Ashkenazic meaning Eastern European, large population of Jews living in Eastern Europe. Now, Jews, Poland is a place we associate with, like, the shtetl. And relatively modern Jewish history. And how much? Who? Anyone here not Ashkenazi? Okay, there's a couple of guys. Most of the rest of you guys are descended from people who came from Eastern Europe, correct? That's the vast majority of the Jewish world. But Poland, the history of the Jews in Poland actually goes back over 700 years. Jews start migrating into Poland around in the 13th century already. Now remember, the great rule of understanding Jewish migration patterns is what? Jews will always, if they're not being expelled, and often it's just moving out of, we have to get out and go somewhere else, which is often the pattern. Jews will always migrate to places where there are greener pastures, meaning that they're being invited in by a nobleman or a bishop or a lord and given a charter and given comfortable conditions and have economic prospects, right, so that they can do reasonably well compared to where they were previously. Poland, Eastern Europe, is always behind Western Europe in terms of political development, intellectual development, you name it. Poland in the 13th century starts to emerge as a fairly strong nation state and wanting to develop. What's the great rule that all monarchs and everyone knows in Europe? If you want to develop your country economically and culturally, who do you need? You need Jews, right. You see, you learn something. So in 1264, King Boleslav of Poland grants a charter inviting the Jews in. I want to read you this because this is an amazing document. If you consider what we talked about of Jews in Western Europe and all the horrible persecutions, listen to this. This is a guy who really wants Jews in the kingdom. This is from the book Scattered Among the Nations, which is, again, an excellent primary source book for documents relating to Jewish history. It says, first of all, that the testimony of a Christian alone may not be admitted in the matter which concerns the money or property of a Jew. In every such instance, there must be the testimony of both a Christian and a Jew. If a Christian injures a Jew in any which way, the accused shall pay a fine to the royal treasury. Notice, by the way, that Jews are protected, but the money doesn't go to the Jew. It goes to the crown because Jews are considered property of the crown. Jews are always considered the property of the local person who allows them to live amongst them. If a Christian desecrates or defiles a Jewish cemetery in any which way, it is our wish that he be punished severely as demanded by law. If a Christian should attack a Jew, the Christian shall be punished as required by the laws of this land. We absolutely forbid anyone to accuse the Jews in our domain of using the blood of human beings. Very nice. We affirm that if any Jew cry out in the night as a result of violence done to him, and his Christian neighbors fail to respond to his cries and do not bring the necessary help, they shall be fined. And last but not least, we also affirm that Jews are free to buy and sell all manner of things, just as Christians, and if anyone hamper them, he shall pay a fine. This is very nice. This is unbelievable, as a matter of fact. Compared to almost any other document I've seen, charter for Jews, this is great. And this is not at a period of time when hundreds of thousands of Jews are coming into Poland yet. This is corresponding to prior to the Jewish expulsion from England in the very late 13th century. But obviously, Poland is a place that wants Jews, and Jews are going to start migrating into Poland. And once the situation becomes untenable for Jews elsewhere, Poland is definitely going to be the place to be. So starting in the 13th century, we're going to have a big rise in Jewish population. And it corresponds to the rise of Poland, because in this period of time, 16th century, jump ahead a little bit further, Poland is going to reunify with Lithuania and get huge tracts of land further to the east. What, as we know, is Ukraine today. A lot of what is Eastern European countries, Belarus, are all going to become vassal states of Poland, which is still a semi-feudal country, which is going to have huge, Polish nobility is going to have huge land holdings in what is the states of today, Ukraine, Lithuania, okay, which means that they need their land managed, and it's going to have a huge impact on why Jews are going to live in Poland. But before we go further, by the way, just to stop and talk a little bit about, go back to the idea of Jewish scholarship at this period of time. I mentioned the printing press before, 1453, Gutenberg, Germany. That's when movable type is invented in Europe. The Chinese actually had it first, but like everything the Chinese invent, the Western Europeans steal it and take credit for it. Spaghetti, the compass, you name it, gunpowder. Ice cream, you name it, they got it. But by the way, it's an interesting side point in history that the genius of the West is not necessarily inventiveness of the West. The West's ability to dominate the world is to a large extent due, in my opinion, which is not my original opinion, to the West's ability to take other people's technology and adopt it more efficiently. Like the Chinese invented gunpowder, but the West learned how to use it effectively in military, in you know, mass armies and battle and tactics. So, anyway, the Christians, when they get a hold of the printing press, which is going to, we're going to see correspond very closely to the Protestant Reformation, is going to be a huge boom for them. The rates of literacy in Europe are going to go through the ceiling. Not because books are now cheap, but books being cheap is going to certainly be part of the process of the spread of literacy. The first Jewish printing press is actually one Sansino set up in Israel, I believe in the 16th century already. But the first thing printed by Jews in 1475 is going to be the Chumash with Rashi's commentary. I mentioned before that Jews don't go nuts over printing the way Gentiles do. And it's interesting. It's not because, and you think that logically, who likes books more than, you know, by the way, if you know anything about the book business in America, Jews have a huge impact on the New York Times bestseller lists, because Jews are the biggest buyers of books, okay, by far in history. Always huge. Jews, most literate people, we love books. You know, it's like just as Jews have a huge influence on presidential elections in America, even though we're 2% of the population, so too Jews have a big influence on what books sell in the United States. But the reason, one of the reasons, and Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, I heard him say this, and it makes a lot of sense, that Jews aren't so nuts about printing, being uncle printing zillions of books, is Jews already had a lot of books. Okay, Jews were literate to a large extent, tremendously high percentage of Jews literate compared to anywhere else in the world, and we had books. Not that every Jew had a huge library. Libraries, someone said to me yesterday, a library in the ancient world like this big, you know. Today I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books. You can buy a book for a few dollars. You know, when books were hand-printed, it was a huge, assuming you could read, it was a very large expense. But Jews had lots of hand-printed books. We had our Talmuds. Everyone did not have a copy of Shas in their house, Talmud, but a lot of people did. People had copies of the Bible. When the Christian world gets into the Bible and then they can buy them cheaply, they go crazy over it. So it's interesting topic. But definitely the printing press is going to for sure affect the Jewish world. For sure. Going back to Poland, I want to read you, jumping ahead in history, because the 16th century is really when everything comes together between this, what's going on in Poland and what's going on in the rest of Europe. And this is really a great example of God opening up another door for the Jewish people as everything else is slammed shut. Remember, by 1492, the largest Jewish community in the world in Spain is being thrown out. They need a place to go. Poland has already been actively involved in trying to recruit Jews. 16th century, Poland inherits large amounts of land in Eastern Europe. They need to expand and efficiently run all their feudal land holdings. Who are the best people to do this? Bring in Jews. And Jews are going to migrate in, and Jews are going to actually, I think, negotiate very well with the Polish authorities. You want us in, we want good terms. I want to read you, just one second, this is, I love this one. This is one of the most funny things I've ever read in terms of a document. This is excerpts from King Segimund II, Augustus. I love these titles. I think in direct proportion to the lack of power a guy has, the title he gives himself. Segimund II, Augustus, granting the Jews permission to open a yeshiva in Lublin, August 23, 1567. This is great. You're going to laugh when you hear this one. As a result of the efforts of our advisors, and in keeping with the request of the Jews of Lublin, we do hereby grant permission to erect the yeshiva and to outfit said yeshiva with all that is required to advance learning. This is not Reb Gil writing. This is an Eish Torah. All the learned men and rabbis of Lublin shall come together. From among them, their number, they shall choose one to serve as the head of the yeshiva. Let their choice be a man who will magnify Torah and bring it glory. This is definitely the king of Poland. I mean, he wants to Yagdil Torah v'yadir. You know, they say, what is going on here? This is clearly like some Jewish advisor saying, Mr. King, just sign this document. You know, like, so, it's very, very funny. But, yeah, you had a question? Okay, it's a very good question. Most Jews do not migrate. The vast majority of Jews I mentioned, the overwhelming majority go to Portugal, where many of them 5 years later are going to be forcibly converted or expelled. The largest number of Jews outside of that is going to go to Turkey. Okay, you do have Jews, however, you have thousands and thousands and thousands of Jews going to all kinds of other places. A lot of them are going to go to Amsterdam area. Many are going to go to Italy. Okay, and a lot of, again, I'll get a little later, hang on, I'm going to read you some sources. We're going to mention the Sephardim living in Germany. So there's definitely thousands of Sephardim living in Western Europe and also in Eastern Europe. Okay, eventually they're going to merge. What's going to happen to them later? You don't find, you know, Sephardi Jews coming from Poland in the year 1900. So if they were there, they're going to meld in and become part of a larger population. A little side topic I didn't mention, by the way. Even after, you have all these Jews who are forcibly converted, the Inquisition hunting them down, many Jews will later escape to greener pastures. Like a lot of Jews will go to the New World and try and go back to being Jews again, because they're secretly practicing Jews anyway. They want to openly practice Jews as Jews. The Inquisition will follow the Jews to Mexico and Brazil and all those places. Jews are going to be burned there. Many Jews, however, will flee to parts of the world that are outside Spanish control and try and come back to being Jews again. Okay, and it's a big, very interesting side topic of the reaction of those Jews who left Spain and how they react to their brethren who chose to convert. And a lot of them aren't too happy about it. Look, can you imagine, like, a guy shows up 10 years later having done really well in business in Spain and now reappears in Italy and says, look, guys, I want to be Jewish again. And there's a lot of interesting halachic responsive and rabbinic literature that's appeared, letters written, how to deal with these people. More or less, most of them are allowed back into the communities. By the way, anyone who has a Sephardi name, Sutton or Seton, a lot of Sephardim have that last name. I have a friend, Isaac Sutton, you know, originally from Lebanon. Sutton is actually comes from Samich Tet, Sephardi Tahor, which is the title that a lot of Sephardim would put after the name to let you know that they never converted to Christianity. They're pure Sephardim. They went the whole 100 yards and took all the pain of staying Jewish, and so you shouldn't have any doubt about their yichus. So it's a very interesting topic, where these people went. So it's not like hundreds of thousands of Spanish, you know, Spanish Jews go to Poland. Not true. They go to a lot of different places. A lot of them are going to go back to the Middle East. We're going to see the big rise of Tzfat in the 16th century. It's going to go through an explosion of population from a few families to like 10,000 Jews. Is going to be, to a large extent, due, and some of the biggest Jewish scholars coming from Spain after the expulsion and settling there. So it's an interesting topic. Any questions? No? Yeah, Max.
I don't know if you're correct. Jewish history, at least compared to Western Europe after the fall of the Roman Empire, at the very least, is so connected to economics.
100%.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if things are going well economically, Jews are pretty much okay. They're given a lot of rights to live and prosper, but as soon as the economics go down, or for whatever reason, the government doesn't even need them for economics, like
well, I wouldn't necessarily, there are plenty of people in history who were doing fine economically and are going to get rid of the Jews anyway and suffer the consequences of it. For sure. In the case of Spain, definitely.
Yeah.
I would say there's definitely a lot of Jewish migration and is definitely linked to economics, for sure. How Jews are treated is not necessarily always related to the idea of economics. But you're right. In the case of Spain, clearly, a combination of Spanish, you know, Christian anti-Semitism, Thomas de Torquemada, the fact that the Spanish felt they no longer believed the Jews, they hated anyway. But that's a common thing, this idea of can't live with them, can't live without them.
Yeah.
We want you, but we... And again, there are examples of Jews being expelled multiple times from the same city, meaning we expel you, and we invite you back in 10 years later. Why? Because we see we only benefited because of you. Like, remember Abimelech, king of the Philistines, saying to Isaac, I see we only did well because of you. Now make a treaty with us and be nice to us. This is the common pattern. You're right, 100%. But that doesn't mean they're not going to throw the Jews out again. It's really schizophrenic. It's almost like it's almost like the world needs, you know, like this giant shrink to deal with their attitude towards the Jews, because it just vacillates between. And again, the greatest vacillations are very interesting. Are always going to be in the communities where the Jews have the. It's like manic depressive almost. You know, anyone know any manic depressive? They have these huge mood swings. The places where the Jews will do the best are almost always the places where the Jews will suffer the worst in the end. Okay, it's really weird. You'd expect there'd be places where Jews are basically okay, and places where Jews are not have a rough time. But that's not what happens. We see the best of times and the worst of times are always going to take place more or less in the same place. We saw it in Spain. You'll see it. We're going to see it now in Poland. We'll see it in Germany. It's one of the great patterns in Jewish history. And we have to always be aware and wary of places where we're doing too well and are too comfortable. Because if we use history as a pattern, we should realize that when we get too comfortable, we might be traveling at high speed, but there could be a solid wall at the end of the tunnel there. You know, people like to ask me, what about the Jews in America? So I always tell that great joke of the guy who jumps off the World Trade Center in New York, 50 stories down, he looks in the window and says, so far, so good. So I'm not a harbinger of doom, gloom and doom. America's a very unique country. We'll talk about that later. But we have to be aware that no place, one of the great lessons of Jewish history, and I meet Jews from South Africa, and I meet Jews from Russia who still want to stay there, I say, you know, read the writing on the wall. When you get an opportunity to get out of a place that's not stable, get out of that place. Okay, because that always is the pattern in Jewish history. Okay, back to Poland. The Polish nobility is going to set up a system called the arenda system, by the way, which is arenda, which is basically feudal estates in Eastern Europe that Jews will basically be brought in to manage. Okay, Jews are going to settle in shtetls. I want to talk about that in a minute. Jews are also given their own sort of governing body called the Vlad Arba Artsot, which is going to exist for quite a long period of time, which is going to be an overall body of rabbis who are going to oversee the affairs of the Jews in Eastern Europe. So there's a lot of autonomy, and the Poles are more than happy to have the Jews there. It's going to be a golden age for the Jewish people. Believe it or not, most people don't know about the golden age of Poland. It sounds like an oxymoron, you know? The golden age of Poland, you know? Everyone immediately thinks of all the Polish jokes, you know? Like, why are there no good seats in the Warsaw Auditorium? Wherever you sit, you're always behind a pole, you know, so, that kind of stuff. But the Golden Age of Poland is actually a very nice period of time for the Jews. And I want to just mention a few personalities, and these are people who are very significant if you get into studying in yeshiva. Very important person, Rav Moshe Isserles, 1530 to 1572, from Krakow. First of all, great Kabbalist, and second of all, he's known, his nickname is the Ramah. Okay, if you read, and I'm going to talk about the Shulchan Aruch a little later, we get to Joseph Caro. The Shulchan Aruch, as we get to Joseph Carr, we'll see, is the codification of all practical application of daily Jewish law. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, is going to add an Ashkenazic commentary onto that. Today, if you read the Mishnah Berurah or the Shulchan Aruch, you'll see in regular script, in regular Hebrew characters, is Rabbi Yosef Karo. It's Machaber, we call him, the author, and then the Ramah. Machaber Ramah, and he's the Ashkenazi commentator. We as Ashkenazim, for those of you guys Sephardim, forgive me, we as Ashkenazim, we go according to the Ramah. Very important person in Jewish history, in terms of modern Jewish law. I had a girl in Discovery about 8 years ago who I speaking to her, I said, what's your last name? She goes, totally secular girl from America, Isserles. I said, oh my God, Isserles. He says, are you related to her? She goes, sure, the Ramah. And she whips out a huge, like 100-page book of her family tree. It's amazing. I told everyone in the yeshiva, the great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter of the Ramah, they're all excited. Anyway, his commentator is called the Mapa. If Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote the Shulchan Aruch, which is the set table, then he's the tablecloth on top of it. Very important person. Another very important person is Rabbi Yehuda Lowy, who's the Maharal of Prague. Okay, from 1526 to 1609, he is one of the great scholars of his time. Okay, he wrote many important works on Jewish thought and Jewish mysticism. He's also the guy associated with the Gollum story, the Gollum of Prague, which, by the way, probably didn't happen. I hate to shatter a great Jewish myth. There are golems. The Talmud talks about people back in the time of the Tanayim doing them. But the Golem of Prague story actually appears much later. Anyone who wants information on that, by the way, Rabbi Ari Kahn does a great class on it. It's very interesting. But okay, about you and I, they don't tell such stories. But if you can still go to his synagogue in Prague, and there's up in the attic, there's a pile of dirt, which is when the golem decomposed, that what he became, you know, who knows. Anyway, yeah.
What's a golem?
A golem is it's where the Frankenstein story comes from. It is a living being without a soul created, which you can use Kabbalah, practical Kabbalah, like not the Kabbalah that we have a deeper understanding of the Torah, but manipulating the forces of nature. You can go by Ari Kaplan as a book, Sefer Yetzirah. How to create animate life, you know? You can buy it, you won't be able to do it. No one does practical Kabbalah today because no one knows how to do it, but there is such an idea. Okay? Don't ask me, I'm not a Kabbalist, I have no idea how you do that stuff. Yeah. Well, abracadabra, it's a sign thing. Abracadabra is Aramaic. Abracadabra, I will create with a word. Okay, interesting, huh? Interesting. Piece of Jewish trivia. Everything goes back to the Jewish people, right? Yeah. L-O-E-W-E, Loewe, the Maharami Prague. And again, he wrote a lot of fantastic stuff. You can read, he has a whole huge set of books on everything. One of the more interesting minds in Jewish history. Another great person is Yaakov Pollock, 1455 to 1530. He's the person who developed the method of learning Talmud, I'm using my thumb already, called Pilpul, you know, the back and forth. That's like his more or less sheet of learning. Rabbi Shalom Shachma, 1490 to 1558. He's a student of Rabbi Pollock. He's the Rosh Hashiva of Lublin. Rabbi Shlomo Luria, the Maharshal, 1520 to 1573. He's the founder of the second great yeshiva in Lublin. I'm just going to read you a list of a couple of names just so you know where they fit in. Rabbi Mordechai Yaffe, he was the Lavush, 1535 to 1612. Rabbi Meir of Lublin, the Maharam. These are all names. You stick around in yeshiva, they'll all come up. 1558 to 1616. Rabbi Shmuel Edels, the Maharsha, 1555 to 1632. You notice they're all at this period of time to the mid-16th century. Late 16th, early 17th century. Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, the Bach. Okay, very important guy in Jewish law. 1561 to 1640. And another person, if you get into studying Shulchan Aruch, is Rabbi David Halevi, the Taz. You're going to read the Shach and the Taz, the Bach and the Taz. These are all very important personalities. He's 1586 to 1667. He, along with Rabbi Shabtai Cohen, who's the Shach, do very important commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. If you make it all the way to the Smicha program, you'll definitely spend a lot of time learning about the Shach and the Taz. Okay, so you're going to, where all these names fit in. Very, very important people. So we have a huge amount of scholarship going on, golden opportunity for Jews to learn and to grow. And along with the growth of the Torah community is going to grow the growth of the Jewish community. The Jewish population of Poland goes nuts. In 1500, there are like 50,000 Jews living in the area of what is Greater Poland. By 1650, there's going to be 500,000 Jews. That's a huge jump from 50,000 to 500,000, which means by 1650, or right before 1650, before the massacres we're going to talk about at the end, about a third of the Jewish population of the world is living in Poland. That's a huge switch. 400 years before, there were no Jews in Poland. Nothing. No one there.
Is anyone
not? Sorry? The entire period of time, Jewish demographers, the estimates I've seen, pretty much from the year 1, or the destruction of the Second Temple, more or less, until more or less, I would say, very early 18th century, the whole world's population. When does the world hit a billion people? Anyone know? Today, the world's at 6 billion people. You know when it hits 1 billion? 1850, 150 years ago, the world goes from 1 billion to 6 billion. Why? Okay, that's industrialization, the rise in standard of living and health and surplus of food, and you name it, whatever. The Jewish population of the world during that entire period of time, until the very early 19th century, is more or less 2,000 years, 1 to 1.5 million Jews. That entire period of Jewish history. All we're going to talk about through the Crusades and the Golden Age of Spain and everything. So 500,000 Jews living in Poland is a huge number of people. Where are they going to go live in Poland? They're definitely going to be Jews living in the major cities. We are very urban people historically, since we didn't own land mostly in most parts of the world for most of history. But because there are so many Jews living in Poland who want to have independent Jewish autonomous living, they're going to go create their own communities, shtetlach, as we call them. You guys are the shtetl, like fiddler on the roof, which by fiddler on the roof story were often very, very poor. But in the golden age of Poland, these communities actually did quite well. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, thousands of such communities in Eastern Europe, most of them destroyed by the Nazis. communities that were overwhelmingly Jewish. Literally a town, you could find little towns that were 90% Jewish, and the 15 Gentile families living in the town all spoke Yiddish. I'm serious. We did a movie in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, a couple of years ago, and I worked with the Russian program. We went back to a little town, which the Nazis came in 1941 and slaughtered all the Jews, and we interviewed the old Russian, Ukrainian peasants who lived there, toothless, you know, typical Slavic-looking peasants. And it's amazing. They're going through in their minds, going back 50 years, and that's where the Goldsteins lived, that's where they lived, and they knew Yiddish. It's unbelievable. They're still using Yiddish phrases, and one of them says, it's amazing, such people, you don't have people like that anymore. Because the Nazis came in and killed all the Jews in the entire town and left the two or three, you know, Gentile families living there. But this is going to be the situation, and the Jews are going to develop their own language called Yiddish, which is very old language, by the way. Jews, wherever we are in the world, develop their own languages. Okay, as I mentioned yesterday, Ladino, which is the language of the Sephardi world, is not Hebrew. It is more or less 14th century Castilian Spanish. Okay, with a little bit of Hebrew thrown in, but it's Judeo-Espanol, as we call it. Okay, if you speak Spanish, anyone who speaks Spanish can understand Ladino, no problem. Okay, Yiddish is a mixture of primarily German with a lot of Hebrew thrown in. And it appears in the medieval period, like around the 13th century, I believe, Yiddish is already formulated as a language. It's going to be the national language of the Jews of Eastern Europe. When I was a student in Moscow years ago, people used to ask me, Russians on the street, when they realized I was Jewish, they asked me, did I speak Jewish? They didn't mean Hebrew, they meant Yiddish. Because all the old Russians, the ones who were like from way back, all knew Yiddish. And this is not just Yiddish, there's a lot of dialects. I was in Miluim, in reserve duty in the army, like 3-4 years ago, and I had this guy, Ronnie, who's from Cochin, India, one of these black Jews from Cochin, India, and he's talking on the phone. There's a couple thousand Jews who were brought over in like the 50s or early 60s. He's talking on the phone to his mother in some really wild language, and I said to him, is that Hindi? He goes, no, this is the language like that the 4,000 Jews of Cochin, India speak. And it's based on Hindu or some Sanskrit language that they speak, but it's a Jewish dialect. You know, so you have two Jews on an island, they build three synagogues, one for each, and a third that neither will get into, neither will pray in, and they also invent their own languages they can't, probably neither one can understand. But obviously all Jews knew Hebrew, so even Jews who spoke Ladino and Yiddish could always communicate with Hebrew to each other. Okay, but it's a very interesting topic, side topic in Jewish history. Yeah. Because it's the language that the Jews invented before they migrate to Poland and take with them.
Were they in German-speaking countries before that?
Yeah, for sure. The majority of early Jewish communities in medieval Europe, we're talking about before the Crusades and even during the Crusades, are going to be in the Rhineland. The earliest Jews, really significant Jewish communities.
Did all Jews spoke Hebrew?
Sorry?
Jews, no.
Hebrew was not a spoken language of the Jewish people until modern times. But all Jews knew Hebrew and can write in Hebrew and can communicate in Hebrew. It's like, but it'd be the equivalent today of like, you know, let's speak, you know, ancient, you know, like Shakespearean English. It was a language that we don't use to converse in, but we can speak in it. I can make myself understood in it, you know. And if you send me a document in Hebrew, I'll be able to understand it. Okay, Jews, by the way, what they're used for by the Poles is tax collectors and to run their estates, more or less. That's the major thing Jews do because they're literate people and very organized and basically reliable people. Who are more or less employed and only living under the protection of the local nobility, they had in their best interest to have a nice symbiotic relationship there. The other thing Jews are going to do, it's very interesting, one of the things that Jews totally will dominate in history, one of the most interesting things you'd least expect, is in Poland, and this is, by the way, true of most places in the world and most of Jewish history, Jews are given a complete monopoly on the distilling and sale of alcohol. Not gasohol for fuel, for drinking. Even today, by the way, many of the sour mash whiskey distilleries in the South of the United States are owned by Jews, including Jack Daniels, by the way, I believe. Okay, it's a great Jewish business. Why? Probably because they didn't drink all the profits. Jews, it's probably one of the reasons why Jews historically are not big drinkers, by the way. Watching what it did to the Gentiles is enough to keep anyone from drinking. I could tell you, go to a place like Ukraine and watch how these people drink, it's scary. The percentage of people in like Russia when I was there, people said 30% of Russians are alcoholics. When they can't get alcohol, they drink the gasohol, they drink the shoe polish, drink the perfume, drink anything, you know? If you had to live in Russia, you'd want to be drunk all the time also. But that's what people did. So Jews were given the right to distill liquor. They're going to have that right until, of course, unfortunately, Tsarist Russia, they'll take that away from them and bankrupt a lot of the Jews. Now, unfortunately, being tax collectors for Poles is not going to make them Jews very popular amongst Ukrainians. Why? Ukrainians hated the Poles. First of all, the Poles were viewed as an occupying power. It's a feudal system. The Poles are the nobility. They have the money. We're the peasants. Not only that, Poles are Catholics. Ukrainians are Eastern Orthodox Christians. Eastern Orthodox Christians don't like Catholics historically, since the Great Schism, you know. in the middle of the 11th century, two different churches. And the Jews, and an Eastern Orthodox church, by the way, is a very superstitious church. Okay, very much more idolatrous. You've been to these churches with the icon stances and the really creepy places. I've been in many of them when I was a student in Russia. A lot of superstitious attitudes. If you think the Western medieval attitude towards the Jews is bad, the Eastern Orthodox attitude is even worse. So for the Jews, who we already think are like devils, to be working for the Polish slime, who we already hate, is not going to put the Jews in a good position. Now, you're definitely going to have instances of anti-Semitism in Poland during this period of time. It's not like total paradise. We know of communities being slaughtered in Posen in 1399. There was a rabbi and 13 elders were accused of stealing church property, and they were tortured and burned at the stake. And there's in 1407 in Krakow, there are anti-Jewish riots. Although the king might want the Jews in, it's not like Poland was like, we love you Jews. There's always a sort of schizophrenic relationship, not just between Jews and Gentiles, but between often the nobility and the local population. Maybe the bishop or the king would grant a charter, but the average Pole on the street does not like Jews. As Menachem Begin said so wonderfully, never one to pull his punches or be diplomatic, as he said, the Poles are anti-Semites, they drink it in their mother's milk. Okay, it's a pretty Beginish statement, but the real problem with the Jews is going to begin in the middle, is going to begin and end in the middle of the 17th century. The massacres of Tach V'Tat, which corresponds to the Hebrew years of 1648 and 1649. The Ukrainians are going to try several times to throw the Poles out of Europe. Now, by the way, in 1618 to 1648 is the 30 Years' War between primarily the French and the Habsburgs in Austria, a very protracted, bloody war that devastates Western Europe. Something like 1 million people are going to die of starvation and the fighting. Poland, by the way, is going to make a mint out of selling food. It's great to be supplying to countries warring with each other. So Poland is going to rise up in power. The rest of Europe is going to go through a lot of problems. Jews, by the way, in that part of the world, are going to suffer tremendously also. But the Ukrainians are also, at the same period of time, going to try and throw the Poles out of Ukraine. And initially, it's not going to be successful, but in 1648 and 1649, in 1635, there's a big explosion of violence in Ukraine against Poles and Jews, which is crushed. But in 1648, 1649, a man by the name of Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who's a big Ukrainian nationalist leader, is going to lead a very successful revolt against the Poles and also go after the Jews. Khmelnytsky is like the Christopher Columbus of Poland, of Ukraine. If you go to downtown Kiev, there's a big statue of him there in the middle of the square. I personally had the pleasure of twice spitting on it when no one was looking. I know someone got arrested for spitting on it, actually. He's one of the biggest anti-Semites. One of the biggest anti-Semites in human history is Bogdan Khmelnytsky, whatever you want to call him. He leads a huge revolt against the Poles, which is initially very successful. The Polish armies are beaten. The king is killed. I want to read you. This is a Rabbi Shabtai Cohen describing the massacres and martyrdom suffered by Polish Jews in the year 1648 and 1649. He's writing this in 1649, so he's contemporary with it. Let me just read. Okay. It says, Know then, if you have not heard it before, you surviving communities of the Lord, you who pray to the Lord and listen trembling to his word, who are dispersed to the four corners of the earth and who are chased into every place where the word of the King of Hosts and his law is present. A great sorrow fell upon the Jews. This has been done by the low and despicable mob of Orthodox Church called Cossacks. Revolting against the king, his princes and vassals, the king was Vladislav IV, and an honest regent, worthy to be counted among the righteous. For he always showed kindness towards the Jews and kept the covenant with them. On the same day, on the same day, 1,500 people were killed in the city of Humen in Russia. On the Sabbath, the nobles with whom the wicked mob had again made an alliance, chased all the Jews from the city into the fields and vineyards, where the villains surrounded them in a circle, stripped them to their skin, and ordered them to lie on the ground. The villains spoke to the Jews with friendly and consoling words. Why do you want to be killed, strangled, and slaughtered like an offering to your God, who poured out his anger upon you without mercy? Would it not be safer for you to worship our gods, our images and crosses, and we would form one people which would unite together? But the holy and faithful people who so often allowed themselves to be murdered for the sake of the Lord raised their voices together in an almighty and heaven and cried, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, thou art the Holy One and the King of the universe. We have been murdered for thy sake so often already. O Lord God of Israel, let us remain faithful to thee. Afterward, they recited the confession of sins and said, We are guilty, and thus recognized the divine judgment. Now the villains turned upon them, and there was not one of them who did not fall victim. The number of all the Jews killed in this two said years amounted to more than 100,000, all honest and excellent people. So it's very interesting, by the way. 100,000 Jews killed, 300 Jewish communities destroyed in the most brutal way possible. If you want to know why Jews, when they hear the word Cossack, they go nuts and they break out in like sweat, is because of the horrendous way the Cossacks, ripping pregnant women's stomachs open, smashing babies' heads on rocks, decapitating people, unbelievable mutilations, terrible stuff. But look at the reaction of the Jewish community. And this is, again, he's not necessarily there, but what he's saying is the classic reaction. Why is this happening? Because we've done something wrong. We don't have our act together. We're not supposed to be here in diaspora. We're supposed to be back in Israel teaching the world. No one's saying, where's God? Very, very interesting. So with 1648, 1649, we come to the Polish golden age of Poland comes crashing down. Jewish community is decimated. Community is destroyed. Doesn't mean all the Jews are going to leave Poland. Poland's still going to be the center.